Paul's second letter to the church in Corinth, and we've been looking together at chapter 8. This chapter and the following chapter, chapter 9, are all about money and giving. If you've been here, you'll remember the background. Paul was organizing a fund to help the church in Jerusalem, which was facing great hardship. Jerusalem and the country around, Judea, were going through a time of famine. So Paul was asking the churches which he had founded in Asia and Greece to give money to his fund. When the collection for the fund was completed, he was planning to travel up to Jerusalem with representatives from the different churches and then to pass the money on to the church in Jerusalem. Well, when the church in Corinth had first heard about this fundraising project, they'd been keen to contribute. Then, for a time, they lost their enthusiasm and they did nothing about it. But more recently, when Titus visited the church, they decided that they wanted to be involved again. So now, in chapters 8 and 9 of Paul's letter to the church, Paul is urging them to get on with it, to give, and to give generously. Now, we've seen that Paul uses various arguments to encourage these Corinthian believers to give. And among those arguments, he talks about the principle of fairness. He points out to the Corinthian believers that in terms of money and possessions, they have more than they need, while the Christians in Jerusalem don't even have the basic necessities of life. So Paul says it's only fair that your abundance should supply their need. That's in verses 13 and 14. As a matter of fairness, your abundance at the present time should supply their need. But then he adds, this is going to be a two-way relationship. You're in a position to help them financially, but they're in a position to help you in other ways. You've got more money than you need, and they're lacking in that way, so you can share your money with them. But they've got more than they need of other things which you're lacking, so they'll be able to share those things with you in due time. And we looked at Romans chapter 15, where Paul shows that he's thinking of spiritual things. The Gentile churches are in a position to share their financial blessings with the church in Jerusalem, but the church in Jerusalem is in a position to share its spiritual blessings with the Gentile churches. The church in Jerusalem had riches, spiritual riches, that none of the other churches enjoyed. There were many people in the Jerusalem church who had known the Lord Jesus personally, who had heard him preach, who had seen his miracles. Some of them will have been among the 500 who met him after the resurrection. That church in Jerusalem had been led and taught by the apostles from the day when that church was born. That church was full of people who, because of their Jewish background, knew the Old Testament very well. They could read it in Hebrew. They'd been trained by the apostles to interpret it rightly. That church, the church in Jerusalem, was simply the oldest church in the world. It was the first to be established. And it had been through lots of crises and had learned lessons from them which could benefit younger churches. So the more contact there was between the church in Jerusalem on the one side And the churches in Asia and Greece on the other side, the more those churches could benefit. Yes, they could help the Jerusalem church financially, but they would gain so much more in exchange. They could learn so many lessons from the church in Jerusalem. You know, even the men who carried the money that had been collected up to Jerusalem, they would come back having learned so much. They'd have that opportunity to see the Jerusalem church in action. They would meet with people who had so much to give spiritually. They would meet with James, the brother of Jesus. What an opportunity to be able to talk to the man who had grown up alongside Jesus in Nazareth. And in years to come, the Jerusalem church would be able to send out workers to help in preaching the gospel in the Gentile world and teaching the Gentile believers. The big lesson is simply this: churches need one another. The churches in one part of the world will have resources that a church in another part of the world lacks. Maybe money, maybe personnel, maybe theological and doctrinal understanding, maybe experience, maybe some particular resource. And there has to be that willingness to give and to receive what is needed. I remember this came home to me vividly some years back. 2001, to be precise, when Anne and I visited Albania together. And we were talking with an earnest young Albanian couple. Now remember, it was only in the beginning of the 1990s that it became legal to preach the gospel in Albania. The country had been dominated by atheistic communism for 40 years. So this was 10 years later. 10 years after liberation, that we were visiting Albania. There wasn't an Albanian Christian in the whole country who had been a Christian for more than 10 years. There wasn't a church in Albania that had been in existence for more than 10 years. Every single adult Christian in those churches, missionaries apart, had grown up under communism and had never known anything else. And this couple we were talking to were reminding us of what that meant. They said, "We've got no models for Christian family life. There isn't one Christian here in the whole country who's grown up in a Christian home and who's seen how a Christian marriage works. And who's seen how Christians bring up their children. We're the first generation of Christians. And we need help," they said. "We need help because we're starting from scratch with no examples to follow. No teaching from people who have built Christian families. No books on the subject." Well, there was very little we could do to help. And we'd only been married ourselves a matter of months. But at least we could talk about our experiences of growing up in Christian families, and we could talk about what we'd seen in other Christian families over the years, and we could talk about what we were hoping for and aspiring to for our family, and we could recommend some books. And I hope they found all that helpful. They've certainly gone on, and I think they've set an example to other Christians for their godly family life. But they needed people from outside Albania to actually bring the experience that we've gained over generations. Same with preaching. There in Albania, new churches were planted very quickly once the borders opened. And those churches had daughter churches and granddaughter churches. But who was going to teach those churches? Who was going to preach to them? The people who had to teach those new churches had never heard expository Bible preaching. The sort of preaching we take for granted, where somebody just works through a passage of the Bible and then spells out the lessons of that passage. They simply had no idea where to start. That's why I was out there. I was asked to go and speak at a conference for church leaders and simply to preach through some part of the Bible for them. Yes, so that they would understand that bit of the Bible better, but more important, so that they could be given an example of how to expound a passage of Scripture. And for many of the men there, that was the very first time they had ever heard someone preaching in that way. It was a complete eye-opener to them. That was the first Fiala conference, and it's continued every year since. And thank God there are now Albanian pastors who are preaching clear Bible expositions, and they unpack the Bible week by week. Some of those pastors who were at that first Fiala conference, they are now the preachers at the Fiala conferences that are being held today. And they're giving examples for the future. So yes, Christians and churches in the UK have a lot to give to believers and churches in Albania in terms of examples and in terms of teaching. But it's equally true that churches here in the UK do need what Christians in other parts of the world have to teach us. I think, for example, about persecution. We've never known what it is to live under organized state persecution. We've always had freedom to live and to worship and to witness openly. We've never had to develop strategies to keep churches safe from the police, from the authorities. But there are dark clouds on our horizon. It may well be that churches in the UK will face real persecution in the not very distant future. And we're not well prepared for it, either spiritually or practically. And it may be that it's now we should be getting the help of believers from other countries who have lived through persecution to help us to prepare. We need their wisdom, we need their experience, we need their example. We need their practical counsels. We need their prayers, because they can pray from the heart for us. So I'll repeat what I said last week. The principle of fairness is not just about money and financial giving. Churches should be sharing all their resources, financial, yes, but social and educational and spiritual, with other churches. It's right for us to ask, are we in a position to help other believers, other churches which are in need? And it's right to ask, are there areas in which we need the help of other believers and churches? Perhaps in other parts of the world. And if so, we shouldn't be afraid to ask. This is the way that God provides for his people today, by encouraging them to share whatever God has given them with other believers who are in need. Well, I want to move on. Paul's given these Christians in Corinth lots of reasons why they should be willing to give to this fund, and to give generously. Now, in verses 16 to 24, Paul starts talking about practical arrangements. In particular, he commends the men whom he's sending with this letter, and who will actually take charge of the money that the Corinthians give. He lists out three men who have been given the job. He explains why these three men in particular, and he talks about the role that they're going to play. First, in verses 16 and 17, he talks about Titus. It's natural that Titus should be involved. He's one of Paul's closest colleagues. He's the one who carried Paul's last letter to Corinth, the stern letter, you remember, which God used to bring that church to repent of the way it had treated Paul. Well, now Paul gives thanks to God. Verse 16. Why? Because God put it into the heart, put into the heart of Titus the same earnest care I have for you. For he, Titus, not only accepted our appeal, but being himself very earnest, he is going to you of his own accord. Paul wants the Corinthians to know that Titus volunteered for this job, and that he did so because of his deep concern for the church in Corinth and its members. Paul talks in verse 16 about his own earnest care, his own loving interest, his own zeal for the Corinthian believers. Well, Titus fully shares Paul's feelings towards them. He has the same earnest care I have for you. Paul, back in verse 8, tells them that he appealed to Titus to go to them. Paul asked Titus whether he would be willing to make that long journey to Corinth again and face that church again. You can imagine Paul saying to Titus, well, I know it's a lot to ask. You know, it's not really fair of me to ask you to go back to Corinth again. But for my sake, would you do this? I'd be so grateful. And you can imagine Paul's relief and delight when Titus says, of course I'll go. And it's not just for your sake, Paul. I'd love to see our friends in Corinth again. I do care about them, you know. Even if you hadn't asked me, I would have wanted to go. Paul and Titus had the same loving concern for those believers in Corinth. And both of them believed that it was for the good of those believers that they should take part in this fundraising project, that they should give. Both of them were convinced that it would be of benefit to that church. Remember, Paul writes back in verse 10, this benefits you. There'll be great benefit for you in giving to the Jerusalem church. You'll reap great blessing from it. Well, Titus sees things the same way. He wants the believers in Corinth to share in the blessing of giving and the rewards that it brings. So Titus is eager to go. Yeah, he's going, yes, as Paul's representative. Paul asked him to go. But it's not just that. He's coming because he wants to. Because he cares deeply for those Christians in Corinth. And Paul thanks God for that. Thanks be to God who put into the heart of Titus the same earnest care I have for you. Paul was sure from the word go that Titus was the right man for the job. He would have wanted Titus to go, even if Titus had been reluctant. But wasn't it lovely that God had already worked in Titus's heart so that Titus actually wanted to go? There are times when we have to do tasks for God that we don't really want to do. But equally, there are times when our generous God, our kind Master, prepares us for work that he's planning for us to do so that we actually want to do it. And then when the opportunity comes, we leap at it. You know, I can remember a very dour Christian man warning me many years ago that if I actually wanted to be involved in some particular Christian activity, it probably meant that I shouldn't. because he said it would mean you're doing it just for your own pleasure, not out of obedience. Well, thank God it's not like that. Very often what we want to do in serving the Lord is exactly the thing we should be doing, because it's God who's given us that thing to do. And it's God who's put that desire into our hearts. On the whole, the man who wants to do something, the eager volunteer, will do it better than the reluctant conscript. If you find that you want to be involved in some form of Christian service, then thank God that he's put that desire in your heart. And if you see another believer who's eager to be involved in some work, don't discourage him. If he knows what it involves and what it would cost him, and if he still wants to do it, then just thank God that God's given him that desire and encourage him forward. That was Paul's attitude here. He knows the trip to Corinth could be difficult and daunting and costly. And I think he would expect Titus, of all men, to be reluctant to take it on, given the stress that Titus has already had through Corinth. And yet Titus, amazing, is actually keen to do it. Well then, Paul can just thank God for that. God must have put that eager desire into his heart. It's a sign that he's the best possible man for the role. He's God's man. Notice just in passing the clear stress on God's sovereignty, God's control of human personalities and feelings and choices. Titus has this earnest care for the Corinthians. Titus is making this choice freely, but Paul thanks God that Titus has that earnest concern in his heart. It's God who's given Titus that earnest concern so that he will make that choice. For every virtue we possess, and every victory won, and every thought of holiness are his alone. It is God who works in you both to will and to do his good pleasure. So that's Titus. He's Paul's choice, but he's also a volunteer who's coming because he wants to. And that's a pointer to the fact that he's God's choice for this job. Who's the second man in the lineup? Verse 18, with him, with Titus, we are sending the brother who is famous among all the churches for his preaching of the gospel. And not only that, but he has been appointed by the churches to travel with us as we carry out this work of grace that is being ministered by us for the glory of the Lord himself and to show our goodwill. So, when Titus arrives in Corinth to take charge of the collection, he'll have with him this second man. In our translation it says he's a man who is famous among all the churches for his preaching of the gospel. Just 2 points of translation there. Firstly, famous isn't really the best translation. More exactly, Paul says, his praise is among all the churches. It's not just that he's famous. You can be famous for very bad things. But he is praised, he is recognized, he's regarded with honor in all the churches. His praise is in all the churches, says Paul. And then secondly, it says in the ESV, he has praise among all the churches for his preaching of the gospel. And the word preaching isn't there in the original. That's been added by the translators because that's what they think Paul meant. But all Paul wrote was that his praise in the gospel is among all the churches. He is recognized, he is honored among all the churches in the gospel. And it's quite difficult to be sure what that means. Yes, it may mean that he's praised for preaching the gospel, but Paul doesn't actually say that. All we know for sure is that the reason why the churches recognize and honor him is in some way related to the gospel. In any case, you can see why Paul says this. He's saying to the Corinthians, this man is trusted by churches everywhere. He's got the highest reputation. Nobody questions his integrity or his motives. So here is someone you can trust. And he adds in verse 19 that this is the man the churches generally have chosen to be involved as their representative in this project. They've asked this man to travel with Paul as he goes round collecting the money. They've asked this man to accompany Paul up to Jerusalem when he goes there to deliver the gift. I presume that when Paul talks about the churches appointing this man, he means especially the churches in the area where he himself is working. Paul had been working for some years in Ephesus, in the Roman province of Asia Minor. And it was while he was there that he conceived this fundraising relief project. So what did Paul do? Well, he consulted the churches in the area. And he said, well, I don't want to go around collecting money just on my own, with no one to keep a check on what's going on. Can you choose a man, please, whom you all trust, who will travel with me to make sure that everything's done properly? And they all agreed that this man was the man they would want in that role. They appointed him. So Titus was Paul's representative, but this man was the, what should we call him, the inspector chosen by the churches because of the trust they all had in him. And this man will be travelling with Paul until the project's complete. He will travel with us as we carry out this act of grace that's being ministered by us. It was important that there should be such a man involved. End of verse 19, for the glory of the Lord himself and to show our goodwill. If there had been the slightest sniff of corruption about this project, if there had been the slightest hint that Paul was failing to act with total integrity, that he was pocketing some of the money or diverting it for other purposes, the glory of the Lord would have been tarnished. God would have been dishonored. The name of the Lord Jesus would have been put to shame. So Paul wants there to be a man like this, checking on everything that's going on, so that God's glory, the glory of the Lord Jesus, won't be threatened. There has to be a man who can testify that everything's been done in an upright way. And he's got to be able to say that Paul willingly accepted such supervision. That's what I think it means when Paul says that it's to show our own goodwill. The fact that Paul is willing to be put under supervision in that way, that in itself shows Paul's integrity. Verse 20, we take this course so that no one should blame us. Nobody should criticize us. Nobody can point a finger at us about this generous gift that's being ministered by us. We aim, he says, at what is honorable, not only in the Lord's sight, but also in the sight of men. People and churches were giving money generously for one purpose: to support the needy believers in Jerusalem. Well, Paul wants to be in a position where nobody can point a finger at him. And he wants his management and his handling of the money to be absolutely transparent, beyond reproach. Yes, he's sure it'll be beyond reproach in the sight of God. He knows that God will know that he's acting with total integrity, but he wants human beings to know it as well. And therefore he welcomes that sort of oversight. He doesn't want anybody to be able to suggest for a moment that he's used any of that money improperly. You know, when Christians are sloppy and careless about the handling of money that's being entrusted to them, even if they're not deliberately dishonest, it brings great dishonour on God's name. You know, some of you will have seen in the papers just in the last few days the scandal over a church near Nottingham and its plan to put on a musical. This is one of our tabloids. Villagers have lost thousands of pounds in savings after a musical organised by their church, which was set for an arena tour featuring Russell Watson, went bust with debts of £2.6 million. Around 30 people living in Mansfield Woodhouse, Nottinghamshire, are owed a total of £500,000 between them. Now they are facing financial ruin, with some even remortgaging their homes to help fund the international church's production. Congregation members were told they were giving to God by helping with heaven on earth, which is based on the story of Adam and Eve. Just 3 weeks before the tour was meant to kick off, the show went bust. It's believed to be one of the largest ever debts from a collapsed theatre production. People working on the production, as well as the arenas booked, are also owed money. Although villagers were told God would provide the rest of the money needed, it ran out of money in late 2017, and Eden International Productions went into administration. The church itself has also gone into liquidation, thanks to the failure of the glitzy show. The villagers affected are unlikely to get their money back. Total mismanagement. In the name of the Lord. The Lord will provide the money that's needed. And the papers report it with glee. Christians again mishandling other people's money. People were willing, gullibly, trustingly, to put money into the hands of these Christian entrepreneurs. And there were no proper checks. There were no guarantees that the venture was feasible. They were just told, trust God. It's a scandal. Well, Paul was determined that there wasn't going to be any scandal about the funds he collected. The people who gave the money were going to have their representative on the spot throughout, making sure that everything was above board. We try to live by that principle as a church. Just one little example. Our treasurer doesn't empty the offering box himself. It has to be emptied by two other church members who write down exactly what's given before the money is handed over to him. Why? Well, don't we trust him? Well, it's not that. We believe he's trustworthy, just as Paul was trustworthy. But we also believe that everything should be done in a way that leaves no room for any suspicions or accusations. We make sure that we can account for every penny that's given to the church and where it's gone to, what it's been spent on. That way, we protect the givers and we protect the man who handles the gifts and we protect the reputation of the church. So that was the second man. And then the third man in the team is introduced in verse 22. And again, Paul calls him our brother. Our brother, whom we have often tested and found earnest in many matters, but is now more earnest than ever because of his great confidence in you. it doesn't sound as if this man is one of Paul's regular team, the workers who travel with Paul. If he were, he would just be duplicating Titus's role. But he is somebody whom Paul has cooperated with in many situations, and he's always shown himself to be dedicated, earnest, zealous. And he's obviously someone who knows the Corinthian church very well. It says he has great confidence in them. He trusts them. And that's why he's willing to be involved. So you've got a genuinely balanced team, haven't you? You've got Titus, who's representing Paul, who's the man behind the whole project. You've got somebody representing the other churches that are supporting the project. And you've got somebody with close connections to the church in Corinth, who's had dealings with them in the past and has great confidence in them. Somebody who's on their side, as it were. Paul sums up their different roles in verse 23. Titus, he says, he's my partner. He's my fellow worker for your benefit. We've worked together to help you in the past. He's coming on that basis. I want to help you. He's coming as my representative to help you. And then the other two, he says, our brothers, they are messengers of the churches. They're representatives of the churches that are giving to this project. The word that's translated messengers is the word that's usually translated apostles. Messengers who are sent with the full authority of whoever sends them. So these are men who have been sent with the full authority of the churches. And then Paul adds, and the churches are for their part the glory of Christ. Christ's glory becomes visible in this world in churches. Churches like these churches. Churches which show generosity and fairness and love. Churches which act with wisdom and integrity. Churches in which God's saving and reconciling work is visible. There in that last phrase, the churches, the glory of Christ, you see what makes this whole project so important for Paul. It's all about Christ's glory. He believes that as these different Gentile churches work together to show love for the Jewish church in Jerusalem, Christ's glory will shine out into this world. As they give generously, following the example of Jesus, Christ's glory will be shining out in their actions. As they conduct their financial affairs with the sort of carefulness and integrity that you see in these verses, that's a way in which Christ's glory becomes visible. Paul and the churches have appointed these three men so that through them Christ might be glorified. You know, it's easy, isn't it, when we talk about Christ's glory being seen in the world, to think of it only in big terms. Revival. Mass outpourings of the Spirit. Great missionary enterprises. But Paul says, the churches are the glory of Christ when they do just the little things rightly, meticulously, with total integrity. When two of our members are called over to empty the offering box and they carefully count the money and note down in the book everything that's been given, Christ's glory is becoming visible in the church. Because you can see in that action Christ's wisdom and Christ's forethought and Christ's integrity among his people. We're holding a members' business meeting in a couple of weeks' time. And when you, the members of the church, scrutinize the accounts and make sure that everything adds up, Christ's glory will be shining in the church. Or as Paul puts it, the church will be Christ's glory. Because it'll be Christ's concern for justice and fairness and honesty that will be visible in that meeting. Churches that handle money irresponsibly, carelessly, bring dishonor to God. Churches where Christ's wisdom and integrity and generosity are seen, even in money matters, are lamps that shine out his glory in this dark world. We'll look at the last verse of the chapter, God willing, next week. But I know that some of you wanted me to answer two last questions before we moved on. Question number one. These two men who were sent with Titus, who were they? And question number two, why doesn't Paul name them? I'll answer question number two first. Or at least I'll tell you what I think the answer is. Different writers, I have to say, have suggested all sorts of reasons why Paul doesn't give their names. I looked at one commentator who listed five possible explanations that have been offered. I won't go through those five, but I'll give you mine. Why doesn't Paul give us their names? I think he does. Or at least he comes very close to it. Paul loved playing with people's names. Do you remember what he says about Onesimus, the runaway slave from the book of Philemon? Onesimus means useful. So Paul writes to Onesimus's master and says, he's my child and formerly he was useless to you, but now he is truly useful. Paul puns on his name. And I think that's what he does here. It's Paul's little joke. I'm sending you the brother whose praise is in all the churches. The word praise is epinos. Well, we know the name of the very first person in the province of Asia to become a Christian. His name was Epainetus. It means the one who's praised. He was the most long-standing and experienced believer in all the churches of Asia Minor. He was the one believer that everybody in all the Asian churches would have heard of. Paul mentions him in Romans 16. So now Paul writes, I'm sending you the one who has praise, recognition, epinos in all the churches. I'm sending you the praised one, Epainetus. And likewise, in verse 22, he says, I'm sending you a brother whom we found earnest, zealous. The word is spudaios. And again, that word was used as a personal name. It's a joke just like the Onesimus joke. This brother's always been spudaios, says Paul. But he's now more spudaios than ever. It would be like us sending a letter with our James to a church in Albania and saying, he's been a good man working here, but we're sure he'll be an even better man with you. Nudge, nudge. So, you know my answer to the first question now as well. Two men, Epainetus and Spudaios. That's my theory anyway. And if I'm right, well, the one lesson I would take from that is that when you're trying to deal with very sensitive matters, a little bit of humour can sometimes help to relax the atmosphere. Paul's relationship with the church and the Christians in Corinth had been so tense in the past. And now he's asking them to dig deep into their pockets to finance his great project. Perhaps a little gentle humour was exactly what was needed at that point. Just as he had to be tactful when he wrote about Onesimus, this is the same sort of tact, a gentle humour that will have made the Corinthians smile.